Well, go ahead and grab your Bibles and turn with me to the book of Ecclesiastes. It's Ecclesiastes, and we'll be in chapter 10 this morning. After today, there are actually only about two more sections left in Ecclesiastes. We could break them down a little bit more than that, but I think two is plenty sufficient for capturing both the purposes and intention of Solomon. And so since that's the case, there will actually only be about two more sermons, Lord willing, until we finish Ecclesiastes. And so with that, my goal this morning is to actually try and walk all the way through the entirety of chapter 10. It is 20 verses, but just given the nature of what these verses are, I think we should have no problem in getting through them. And this chapter does bring us to a rather interesting section in Solomon's writing. As you can see, I've entitled this passage, if you have the notes, Life Lessons. And my reason for doing that is because what we have in chapter 10 is actually just another series of Proverbs. And so if you remember, Solomon actually did this back in chapter 7, which I actually broke into two parts. And so here in chapter 10, he returns to yet another set of his Proverbs. Now, unlike chapter 7, these Proverbs do seem to contain a rather consistent and overall theme, which without a doubt here is lessons and warnings on the nature of leadership, particularly political leadership, which is what I almost entitled this section. But while leadership does seem to be the overall theme of Solomon, he does touch on a range of topics within that theme. And so since that's the case, I did just stick with the more generic title here of Life Lessons. That's what Proverbs are. Furthermore, since this chapter is really nothing more than a series of proverbial sayings, similar to chapter 7, Solomon does tend to just sort of jump from one topic or idea here to the next. And so just like the first two sermons from chapter 7, this one will also tend to contain a little rigidity and maybe even feel a little bit choppy at times. But that is the nature of Solomon's structure. And so just like the words and ideas of the biblical text, as you know, the structure of any passage is also equally inspired. And so what we're going to do is just attempt to walk through these Proverbs this morning and see what God might have for us. So let's go ahead and read it, and then we'll jump in. So that's chapter 10, beginning in verse 1. Solomon writes, "Dead flies make a perfumer's oil stink, so a little foolishness is weightier than wisdom and honor. A wise man's heart directs him toward the right, but a foolish man's heart directs him toward the left. Even when the fool walks along the road, his sense is lacking, and he demonstrates to everyone that he is a fool. If the ruler's temper rises against you, do not abandon your position, because composure allays great offenses. There is an evil I have seen under the sun, like an error which goes forth from the ruler. Folly is set in many exalted places, while rich men sit in humble places. I have seen slaves riding on horses and princes walking like slaves on the land. He who digs a pit may fall into it, and a serpent may bite him who breaks through a wall. He who quarries stones may be hurt by them, and he who splits logs may be endangered by them. If the axe is dull and he does not sharpen its edge, then he must exert more strength. Therefore, wisdom has the advantage of giving success. For if the serpent bites before being charmed, there is no profit for the charmer. Words from the mouth of the wise man are gracious, while the lips of a fool consume him. The beginning of his talking is folly, and the end of it is madness. Yet the fool multiplies words, and no man knows what will happen, and who can tell him what will come after him? The toil of a fool so wearies him that he does not even know how to go to a city. Woe to you, O land, whose king is a lad and whose princes feast in the morning. But blessed are you, O land, whose king is of nobility and whose princes eat at the appropriate time for strength and not for drunkenness. Through indolence the rafters sag, and through slackness the house leaks. Men prepare a meal for enjoyment, and wine makes life merry, and money is the answer to everything. Furthermore, in your bedchamber do not curse a king, and in your sleeping rooms do not curse a rich man, for a bird of the heavens will carry the sound, and the winged creature will make the matter known." Well, I think it is a fair statement to say that many view wisdom and even approach wisdom as if it's something that if they can just learn to get right, then all of their problems will be forever solved. If you could just figure out the right formula or learn the right thing to say or learn the right time to say the right thing, if you could just learn some kind of foolproof mechanism through which you could just sort of filter all of your goals and decisions, then all that ails you and all that seeks to distract and get in your way will just no longer be an issue. All of your relationships will be fixed. You'll climb up the corporate ladder. Ease and contentment will be yours, and life will be bliss. I just think that's how many approach wisdom. It's how most tend to approach the Proverbs. They view them as a series of formulas or incantations. But what Solomon has been showing us, especially at the end of chapter 9, is that while wisdom is always better than folly, the reality is that wisdom has incredible limitations. And the reason for that is because while wisdom is living God's way and God's world under God's rule and in accordance to God's design that he established at creation, it was after creation that the fall happened. And so when sin entered the world, God cursed it. And you can read about that in Genesis chapter 3. And so when God cursed this world, the Bible says that it actually became fractured, that it became twisted and distorted and even upside down. And so while wisdom does say that there's just a right way to live and work and make decisions, it's just not always so easy. And so the straight and even clear-cut nature of what God's wisdom is supposed to be, it sometimes has difficulty fitting into the bent and twisted things of life. And so while wisdom still, generally speaking, is always better than folly, there are these times in which wisdom is going to fail you, where wisdom doesn't make sense, where it doesn't solve or bring any kind of remedy to what has become an bent, fractured, broken world, an insolvable problem. Which is actually why in a time where so many are looking for solutions and answers to their many problems of life, no matter what they hear, what they try, they just keep bouncing from one thing to the next, hoping that it'll finally solve the problem. But they just keep coming up empty. And so Solomon, all through this book, has just been observing this kind of reality. The kind of reality in which justice has become twisted and perverted. A kind of reality in which the innocent and hardworking are oppressed, all the while the guilty and the wicked just seem to prosper in their wickedness. A kind of reality in which all that is good and true and right and even proper is now called evil and malicious, all the while that which is truly evil and truly malicious is not only permitted, but actually praised. This is a world of brokenness. It's filled with folly. It's filled with perversion. It's simply upside down to the way that things are supposed to be. And Solomon knows this. And so throughout these first 9 chapters here, he's just been observing that these kinds of things are part of life. They're just part of what it means to live a life under the sun. And so it's from these observations that he's been giving us some counsel for how to live in light of these realities. And so while he has said that there is no ultimate solution to this kind of existence, that is to a permanently bent and permanently backwards reality, there is still just a wise way to approach this life and then navigate through this life. And so for almost all of this book, we've been seeing Solomon's desire to give us wisdom. And so while it is a form of divine wisdom, if you've been with us from the beginning, you'll know that it's actually a different kind of divine wisdom. It's been a kind of wisdom that we refer to as non-traditional wisdom. That is, it's not the sort of proverbial wisdom that we're used to reading in the Proverbs. But what he's going to do this morning here in chapter 10 is something somewhat rare for Solomon within the book of Ecclesiastes. We've seen it once already, but we'll see it again today. And that is that he's going to dispense with some of his more traditional proverbial wisdom. And you can see that just in the structure of some of these statements. But let me say here that while he is going to give us some of his more traditional wisdom, he is going to use that wisdom to still speak into the more twisted things of life. And so while he has affirmed that wisdom won't actually solve any of the permanent problems of life, and that wisdom still does have its limitations. It's still divine wisdom. There are still laws and rules built into the very structure of what God has designed this world to be, and so this wisdom is still useful, or as Solomon would say, better than the way of the fool. And so what we're going to attempt to do this morning is walk through these Proverbs here, beginning in verse 1. So look at what he says to start. He writes, "Dead flies make a perfumer's oil stink, so a little foolishness is weightier than wisdom and honor." Now, this is actually a continuation from his final statement in verse 18 of chapter 9. And so if you remember from last time, he just got done saying that no matter how much wisdom or how much sound reason might come together to determine that which is good and right and maybe even true, at the end of the day, no matter how much wisdom is present, all that it takes to turn the room upside down or influence the masses is just one. It takes just one voice, one influence, one message of a fool who is loud, proud, and boisterous to just completely destroy that which is good. And so I just spent some time there trying to draw out some of the implications of this principle for our day. That while Solomon is warning his son in a more political setting here against things like uprisings and revolts, this is still something that is incredibly true within our culture. That we live in a day in which the voice that has influence and the voice that is loud and can so often capture the mind and affections of our hearts is simply the voice of this age. And so in verse 1 of chapter 10, what Solomon's doing is really nothing more than building upon this idea. And so while verse 18 of chapter 9 is a reference to the destruction that a fool can have within a community, when we get to verse 1 of chapter 10, he's actually giving a picture of the destruction that a fool can therefore bring upon himself. And so while the meaning of the proverb here is to say that no matter how much good a person does or how much wisdom they might actually possess, all it takes to destroy them and all it takes to completely undo that which is normally good and right and wise is just a little foolishness. Just one moment of weakness, one moment of anger or letting the tongue slip, and it has this way of just completely undoing everything that you had going for you. And some of you know exactly what this is. You had that experience where your blood boiled, where you made a bad decision, or you decided you were going to take matters into your own hands. And so all that was good and all that was right and all that was maybe promised in that moment became like sand between your fingers. And so you have regret. You have this haunting memory, this ever-present guilt of maybe wishing you could somehow have back that moment. And so Solomon here is just giving a proverb to reflect the reality of that kind of situation. And so the clear warning here in the simplest of proverbs is to be aware. Be aware of what you do. Take care with what you say and the emotions of the moment. For as he says, even a person with much wisdom can be ruined by the littlest fly of their folly. And then in verses 2 and 3, building from verse 1, he writes this. He says, "A wise man's heart directs him toward the right, but the foolish man's heart directs him toward the left." That's not a statement about Republicans. "Even when the fool walks along the road, his sense is lacking, and he demonstrates to everyone that he is a fool." Now, in Solomon's day, this would have been a rather obvious proverb. It would have been one of those things that you just sort of stick in your mind and hang on to. And the reason for that is because all throughout the scriptures, what it means to be at the right hand is to be a person who actually sits in the place of privilege and prosperity. Often to be at the right hand meant that you were a person who had incredible power. You were the one who would defend a king, literally. You might stand by his side and wield a sword of both defense and execution. But beyond that, you might remember from places like Genesis that Jacob's right hand was actually his hand of blessing. Or in Psalm 16:11, speaking of salvation, David writes of Yahweh that at your right hand there are pleasures forevermore. And then on the opposite side, in Matthew 25, Jesus is talking about the wicked, and he actually speaks about them as being sent to the left in the judgment, where in the judgment the sheep go to the right, but the goats go to the left. And so the point to know here is that the image of right and left are actually these biblical categories that speak with reference to both the path of prosperity and salvation and the path of folly and destruction. And so the meaning here, building off of what he just said in verse 1, is that the ability to discern between who is wise and who is foolish is just not something that's a giant mystery. In other words, the way I would say it is that your life is always preaching, regardless of what you say or what you try to make appear as reality. The truth of the matter is that the way that you live and the decisions that you make, these are not things which you can just sort of hide. And so unless you're just a complete hermit to society, the reality is that we all live within community, even within your home. We all live in public. We all live before the eyes of somebody else. And now with the advent of things like social media, the fool's just completely lost his filter. And so what Solomon's getting at behind this proverb, knowing that it is something he's giving to his son in the context of political leadership, is that a wise person is someone who learns to seek wisdom from the wise. Now, this might not be the deepest of all proverbs, but it is the one, to my mind, that is probably most neglected. Now, I am consistently perplexed at the amount of times that I see people counsel and seek counsel, and it could be even on the smallest of issues, from a person that, quite frankly, has no business giving counsel. And actually, one of the things I'm beginning to conclude is that people do this not because they're actually convinced that they're going to get wise counsel, but because they're more interested in surrounding themselves with people that they know will affirm them and what they want to be true or right or wise. In other words, people they know will agree and affirm and even encourage them in their folly. But the point of Solomon here is not so much to indict the person who's giving the poor counsel as much as it's to expose the foolish nature of anyone who decides to seek counsel from a fool. And notice in verse 2, the heart of the fool is actually inclined to go to the left. In other words, in light of actually being able to discern wisdom from folly, the fool still just chooses to go down the path of folly. They choose to go to the left. Their heart actually directs them to the left. They can't not be there. They're just drawn to the ways of folly. There's just something inside of them that gets excited about fellowship with folly. They laugh at wickedness. They applaud proudness. They're a person just given to a path of what the Proverbs call self-destruction, even though they recognize that their life is difficult and feel the effects of their own folly. And so for Solomon, this is the thing that's so entirely perplexing. They look around and see the prosperity of wisdom. They see joy and happiness, which is one of the marks of true wisdom. Maybe even the contentment with which the wise can live their lives, and yet despite recognizing such things, they still choose to bury themselves in folly. The fool hates wisdom. They hate admitting that their way is wrong or even difficult. And then notice verse 3, even in the midst of their self-destruction, they still lack the sense to get off the road. They actually scoff in their arrogance. They spend their life in self-inflicted pain. Everybody's wrong. Everybody's after me. They take on this sort of victim mentality and are completely lacking in their ability to see that the problem is actually with them. And so Solomon here, seeing such things, just says, avoid such thinking. Fools are always easy to see, and you would do well to avoid their paths. So stay on the right, pursue wisdom, seek the counsel of the wise, and do not assume that you're actually on the path of wisdom. And so I think Solomon would say, when it comes to the issue of seeking counsel, is just look at a person's life. Do you see wisdom or do you see folly? Do you see a path of destruction or do you see a path of peace and wholeness and righteousness? Solomon says these are the ones to follow and these are the ones whose life you should model. Verse 4, and I have to pick it up a bit. He states, if the ruler's temper rises against you, do not abandon your position, for composure allays great offenses. This is just talking about the fact that there's going to be these times where if you're a person of integrity and you possess wisdom, there's just going to be these times where you're going to say something or maybe even take a stand against the position of a superior. And then because you don't agree with them or because your position makes you become a sort of stick in the mud in their eyes, they're going to get mad at you. Quite literally, you're going to incite their temper. Now, Solomon, being a king, no doubt knew this from experience and is therefore able to give a rather interesting perspective. And especially because he's coming from the perspective of one who is the superior, that is, the one who's perhaps gotten angry. And so Solomon's counsel as the one who's had to deal with the proverbial stick in the mud is that the best thing that a person can do in this kind of situation is actually refuse to join the rest of the yes men and actually stand firm, or as he says here, composed. And so his point is that there's actually a kind of witness or defense that you come to possess when in the midst of a superior's anger, you not only remain calm or composed, but also refuse to abandon your position and just collapse under the pressure. And so Solomon says, in the midst of that moment, it is a wise person and the one of integrity who refuses to fold and stand firm. In fact, this is actually your greatest defense, he says. And so his point is that if both you and the superior are people of wisdom, and that's important, they both must be people of wisdom, after the temper resides, it is your wisdom which will win the day. For it is your anger, even if it's righteous, which will perhaps ruin you. And then in verses 5 and 6, he says this. He states, there is an evil I have seen under the sun, like an error which goes forth from the ruler. Folly is set in many exalted places, while rich or wise men sit in humble places. I have seen slaves riding on horses and princes walking like slaves on the land. This is just Solomon's observations that there can be an incredible amount of folly in leadership. It speaks to the fact, or rather illustrates the fact, that leaders often will put fools or unqualified people into places of power and yet stick the wise or those who do possess the skills into places of little influence. Now, this is certainly true in government, but it's also true in multiple areas of life. So whether it be work or sports and leisure or maybe within the church, the meaning of Solomon is there's just this reality in which politics and even pride rule the day, and this is a great evil. One commentator, Dwayne Garrett, states it this way. He says, the folly of a fool is generally self-evident, verses 2 and 3. Nevertheless, kings often make the mistake of promoting such men into positions of power. Now, as one man observes on this, what makes this situation tragic here is actually something that we see right within the context of these very proverbs. There's just this reality in which a ruler, maybe even a righteous ruler, will act, and it'll be his fly in the ointment, so to speak, where in a moment of weakness or perhaps just oversight, they'll actually put a fool into a position of power. And so what'll make that situation incredibly difficult, or as he says here, evil, or just hard to deal with, is that the one fool will actually end up destroying all that is good and therefore spoiling the perfumer's oil. And the reason this is so tragic is because while the fool is wreaking his woes, the ruler actually does possess skilled, wise people, which is what he means here by rich, but they're just sitting useless in humble or uninfluential places. In other words, he actually holds assets in his arsenal or right under his nose, but it is the fool to whom he's given charge. This is a warning for which Solomon, perhaps even from experience, is giving to his son. He's just saying, don't be blinded. Don't be played. Do not assume that what you see in the beginning is still the reality of what is going on. And so while verse 6 is a statement with regard to the backwards and individual situations, verse 7 is a commentary then on the upheaval of what happens sometimes in social structure. It's just the kind of thing that happens when folly is placed into power, especially within government. And then in verses 8 through 11, he writes this. He states, "He who digs a pit may fall into it, and a serpent may bite him who breaks through a wall. He who quarries stones may be hurt by them, and he who splits logs may be endangered by them. If the axe is dull and he does not sharpen its edge, then he must exert more strength. Wisdom has the advantage of giving success. For if the serpent bites before being charmed, there is no profit to the charmer." Now, the point of these verses is really just to give a statement about the advantage and oftentimes the gain that's brought about by possessing wisdom. In fact, that's actually explicitly stated here at the end of verse 10. But the fuller meaning of the Proverbs are actually designed to communicate something about the nature of life. And so what we have here in verses 8 and 9 with these illustrations is just Solomon's way of acknowledging that living life under the sun means that there's just an inherent risk to everything that we do. That none of us are actually able to predict the outcome or possess any kind of guarantee. And so since that's the case, there's just this risk and even unknown reality to everything that we do. And so his point then is that it's actually the beginning of wisdom when a person begins to recognize and even accept the fact that no matter how much they might seek wisdom and then act in accordance to that wisdom, they'll never actually eliminate the ever-present reality of the unknowns, of what could happen. In fact, this is why something like decision-making can become so difficult for some, where they can actually become paralyzed by the unknowns. But what Solomon is saying here is that regardless of what you might have before you, the reality is that you still have to decide. You still have to take action. You still have to make some kind of move, or you simply become the victim of your own passivity, which is still a decision. You simply let the world and chance decide for you what's to come. And so his simple point here is just to say life involves risk. That's just the nature of a life lived under the sun. You and I are finite. We just don't know what's to come. And so actually one of the marks of wisdom is that you actually begin to accept the fact that you can't make all of your unknowns go away. And so his point here, when all is said and done, is that even in the face of risk, there's still just an advantage to weighing out life with wisdom. That there's a way to do things and think about things and act or maybe not act, built into the very structure of God's design in this world, that while Solomon never actually says that risk will disappear, wisdom does bring a kind of advantage that is profitable. And so he just says that no matter how much frustration might come your way, just don't ever abandon wisdom. Don't throw off counsel or instruction. It's a call to always seek counsel, always consult the trusted. And so Solomon says, know that there is risk. Understand that you can't eliminate the unknowns. You are not God. You don't know what's to come. And so he just says that the way of the wise is to sharpen the axe before you start swinging. That is, consult wisdom, seek counsel, and trust yourself to those who have proven faithful. It is in the midst of the many unknowns of life that we must never forget that wisdom and care of thought is always better than the spontaneous nature of emotional folly. And so he just says, sharpen your axe before you swing. A long way of saying, seek counsel. Next, verses 12 through 15. He writes, "Words from the mouth of a wise man are gracious, while the lips of a fool consume him. The beginning of his talking is folly, and the end of it is wicked madness, or literally evil delusion. Yet the fool multiplies words. No man knows what will happen, and who can tell him what will come after him? The toil of a fool so wearies him that he does not even know how to go to a city. So he just begins here by saying that a wise man's words are gracious, while the lips of a fool have this way of actually consuming him, literally destroying him. And so what you have here is a typical proverb where Solomon's really doing nothing more than contrasting the benefits of wisdom from the destruction of folly. But the focus of the section is not so much to talk about folly in general as much as it's to draw attention to the nature of a fool's tongue, of the kind of destruction that often results from a fool's mouth. So notice how he begins. He says, the words of the wise are gracious, or just simply grace. In other words, they benefit others. That is, they bring something good to those around them. While the words of the fool consume him. In other words, they bring destruction to himself. Now, all throughout the Proverbs, it's hard to miss how many of them are actually connected in one way or another to speech or with a person's words. And the reason for that is because what a person says or maybe doesn't say always has its origins in a person's heart. That is, in what defines them or drives them. And so it's actually what a person says and the tone with which they say it that actually becomes a pretty good gauge of a person's wisdom and folly. And so Solomon here, already knowing this to be true, says that the mark of a wise person is actually that their speech is the kind of speech that builds up. One man put it this way. He said, the words of the wise are gracious in content, winsome in spirit, affectionate in appeal, and compliant and affable in tone. The fool, on the other hand, from start to finish, displays a complete lack of wisdom, which often results in madness. And so the Proverbs, and really all throughout the Scriptures, we see that a wise person's words are always a fountain of life. They give hope. They encourage a downcast spirit. They function as a kind of balm to a person's soul, where in the midst of darkness and confusion, the words have this way of actually bringing light. There's just this quality to a wise person's words that not only build up and even edify those around them, but are also the kinds of words that are actually invited. Contrast that with the fool. And we all know one. The kind of person that when you're around them, you're actually careful about what you choose to say, aren't you? You don't want to accidentally invite some of their counsel or what they would call words of wisdom. The kind of person here, as Solomon says, who actually consumes themselves. They're constantly in trouble. Their life is not one to be modeled. It's a complete wreck, and every area of life they try to speak into is an area of life for which they've actually destroyed. It's this weird thing that happens. They're constantly sticking their foot in their mouth. They are, as one man comments on this verse, self-cannibalistic. That is, the very thing that they use to consume food, their mouth, is the very means through which they destroy and consume themselves. Their life reflects folly. Their words drip destruction. Why is it the person who's been married three times is the person who thinks they should be giving marriage counsel? Why is it the person whose children hate them and have actually abandoned them, or whose children have completely gone off the rails, is the one who thinks they should be giving parenting advice? Why is it that the person who can't seem to hold a job thinks they should be the one forever giving career advice? This is quite simply the way of the fool. They're always the one who, as it says here in verse 14, just keep multiplying their words. They've never learned to simply close their mouth, open their ears, and consider the fact that perhaps there's still something that needs to be learned. They are, as Proverbs 18 so fittingly summarizes, a person who does not delight in understanding, but only in revealing their own mind. They can't stop talking. They can't stop speaking. They multiply their words despite the fact that no one is actually listening to them. In fact, this is what a little child does, isn't it? They actually think that they have a better argument than their parent. They actually think that they have weight to their words and that what they say seems to mean something. This is why it's so important to actually look at a person's life before you begin to weigh out their wisdom. Look at their children. Look at their career. Watch their marriage. Life is always the best judge of wisdom and revealer of folly. And so if you're ever wondering just who it is that you should be listening to, or confused about which voices you ought let speak into your life, do not try and merely weigh what a person says. That is their words of wisdom. In fact, this is one of the reasons for why the writer to the Hebrews said in chapter 13, remember those who led you and spoke the word of God to you. And considering the result of their conduct, imitate their faith. In other words, look at their life. It is not hard to just keep asking people what they think you should do until you can just sort of find a person who will just agree with you or affirm you in what you want to be true or wise. We all do this. But it is much more difficult to find a person whose life and conduct and the fruit of whose decision-making is in conformity to the person of Christ and then ask them what they think you should do and then actually follow their counsel. That is a much more difficult thing to do. Because it's usually hard and not simple. It doesn't just happen overnight. We so much want these instant fixes, don't we? We want instant gratification, instant success and ease, but the path of wisdom is not short. It is not easy. It often involves sacrifice and the willingness to embrace hardship. So Solomon says, the words of a fool are a dime a dozen. They're easy to find, seemingly easy to follow, simple to seek out, because most of the time all a fool does is multiply their words. They're everywhere. They just keep talking, and sadly many listen. And so in verse 14 he says, no man knows what will happen, and who can tell him what will come after him? The ironic thing about a fool and his words is that despite the fact that his folly has ruined him, and despite the fact that he's most certainly wrong and totally unable to predict any kind of outcome to his words, the nature of how a fool speaks is that they often talk as if what they're saying is some kind of guaranteed truth. As if they've somehow seen the future and that their words can secure it. But the point of Solomon is that not even the wise know what's to come, much less the fool. And so we see this all the time. Follow these three steps and your life will be perfect. Try this technique in bed and your marriage will be fixed. Get your children involved in that program and they'll somehow be successful. These are the lies of this age, and there's not a person on this earth who actually knows what's to come. Not even the wise can predict the future. So Solomon says, those who speak with such certainty are often those whose life is such a wreck. And you see this in verse 15. He says, the toil or just efforts of a fool has so wearied him that he does not even know how to get himself to a city, which in the ancient days would have been so obvious. Just find the nearest road and you'll get there. The greatest tragedy about the life of a fool is that they're so delusional who they think and what they actually think they know, that they don't even know that their life is a wreck. They are their worst enemy. Everybody around them knows it and sees it. Doug Wilson describes this breed of a fool as a little boy who can somehow manage to get himself lost even on an escalator. There's just a clear path. There's a wide road with all of the signage pointing in the right direction, but they're so busy talking and so full of their own wisdom that they never actually get around to seeing the destructive nature of their own folly. And so Solomon says, avoid such people. These are the kind who know not what's to come, nor the path of godliness. Observe their life, see their weariness, learn the fruit of their decision, and observe for yourself the ways of wisdom and folly. Next, verses 16 and 17. He writes, "Woe to you, O land, whose king is a lad and whose princes feast in the morning. Blessed are you, O land, whose king is of nobility and whose princes eat at the appropriate time for strength and not for drunkenness." Now here, as you can see, Solomon issues a judgment, or more accurately, a curse, and then a blessing. And as you can tell, the scene here is a political one. And so he's simply observing the result of certain choices in leadership. Now to begin, he declares a woe over a land whose king is a lad and whose princes feast in the morning. Now this is not a statement that Solomon is somehow against rulers or leaders that are simply younger in age. For this you can reference chapter 4 and verse 13. But it is an indictment against certain practices that are typically more prone to accompany those who are younger in leadership, specifically political leadership or those in places of judgment. And the practices that he has in mind here, due to this phrase, feasting in the morning, are those practices related to things like gluttony and drunkenness. You see this actually in Isaiah chapter 5, where Isaiah declares woes over those who get up in the morning to pursue drink. He states, "Those who do such things accept bribes and declare the innocent guilty." And so Solomon here, painting a picture on some observations that he's been seeing in the world, warns against leaders placing certain people into power who will simply use their position to not only indulge themselves, but actually exploit it as a means to pursue their own personal pleasure, ease, and prosperity. The simple reality of leadership, and it really doesn't matter which realm of leadership you want to talk about, but leadership always carries with it the temptation to become self-indulgent, which is the picture that he's creating. As we've seen, the purpose and function of leadership, as it's been established by God, is always to bring benefit to those who are underneath. But as we all know, and the reality of life and the nature of what it means to live in a twisted, broken world is that many simply see it as an opportunity to bring self-gain. You see this in politics. You see it in the workplace. You see it even within churches and families. It is incredibly easy to become lazy and self-absorbed, self-indulgent, self-serving, all of those things when you're in a position that no one actually has the ability to question. And so Solomon says, when this happens, it is a bad thing for those over whom this leader presides. It's just a matter of time before devastation or woe comes upon the land or arena over which they have authority. It is an incredibly good thing, on the other hand, for a land or even an organization when the leadership is aware of the purpose and function of their role. They understand how to use their authority and resources for good. They understand they're not there for personal pleasure, but for the task of bringing about prosperity. And so the mark of a good leader is not that they become drunk with their authority where everything just sort of becomes about them, but instead views themselves as a servant, as one who's been put into power for the purpose of prospering the people and working tirelessly for their good. Solomon calls this a blessing. It's in accordance to the way that God has designed this world, and it is something which typically accompanies leaders of experience, wisdom, and as he says here, nobility of character. So Solomon says, be wise, especially if you're the one put into power. There is just a kind of end-time justice that God will bring to every situation. In fact, this is the very counsel his son rejected, and as you know, just ended up splitting the kingdom. And then in verses 18 and 19, he just sort of expands upon the point. He says, through indolence the rafters sag, and through slackness the house leaks. Men prepare a meal for enjoyment. Wine makes life merry, and money is the answer to everything. So in verses 12 and 15, we saw that the mark of a fool is one who is destructive with his words. In 16 and 17, the mark of a fool is one who exploits his position. And so here in 18 and 19, the mark of a fool for Solomon is the quintessential proverbial sluggard. But having said that, well, this is one of those situations where due to a person's folly in the form of laziness, he can bring disaster to himself. That's what it means to be a sluggard. But keeping in theme with the political context, the statement is most likely a reference to the disaster that a leader can cause if they just choose to sort of ignore everyday details of leadership. And so this is one of those statements that speaks to the fact that it's incredibly easy for those in authority and leadership to just assume that everything is just sort of taken care of. They run on the assumption that everyone is doing what they should be doing. They neglect areas of management simply due to past success or performance. Perhaps they choose to neglect the seemingly less important things because they've shifted in their mind into thinking they're only worthy of dealing with so-called bigger issues of a nation or organization. Now, this isn't to say that there aren't times where a leader does need to focus on more pressing matters or perhaps bigger issues that might be going on, but it is an indictment, especially when there are no bigger issues, against those who simply choose to neglect the everyday matters of routine leadership. But more to the point, it's simply a warning against passivity due to familiarity and laziness. Solomon says that kind of approach and view toward any office is never anything less than the kind of approach that'll eventually bring down the house. Now, the connection to verse 19 is Solomon's attempt to keep a consistent theology. If you remember, he's just been saying over and over again all throughout this book that one of the purest views and approaches to life is that God has actually given it to us for enjoyment. And so what he doesn't want in condemning the sluggard here is for his listener to somehow swing the pendulum too far the other way. There are those who do pride themselves on their work ethic. They are the kind who make little time for play and drink or just plain rest. And so Solomon says that the mark of wisdom is not that a person becomes a bum or that they become a workaholic, but actually that they have a balanced view toward both work and rest. In fact, they're the kind of person who can view work and labor, which is what is meant here by money, as the means of gaining the ability to enjoy the everyday gifts of God. That's his point. In fact, the verse is actually better translated as, "Prepare a meal for enjoyment, wine will make life merry, and money is the means through which you do this." One commentator translates it this way. He says, "People prepare food for pleasure and wine makes life joyful, but money pays for both." Now notice he's not saying here that you should get a better job and work more hours so that you might be able to upgrade to a bigger house, faster car, and deeper pool. But he is saying that your view toward work and your understanding of labor is that it's simply a means through which you might pursue and enjoy the everyday details of life. In fact, this is completely consistent with his statements in chapter 2, 3, 5, 8, 9, and what he's going to go on to say in chapter 11. Solomon is just a man committed to the enjoyment of life. He's a man who views enjoyment as a gift of God, and so he knows that it's what you've been created for, and therefore what a life of understanding looks like. And so he just says here, it is a sign of wisdom if a person can reject the folly of laziness, pursue the gift of work, but in the end have a balanced perspective of both. And finally, verse 20. He concludes, "Furthermore, in your bedchamber, do not curse a king, and in your sleeping rooms, do not curse a rich man." Why? "For a bird of the heavens will carry the sound, and the winged creature will make the matter known." Now, what Solomon's doing here is really nothing more than ending on a simple warning, and it requires almost no comment. There is this reality to life where those in power and those in authority have this way, just by virtue of their position, of finding certain things out. Especially in the context of politics, where everyone is trying to move up the ladder and endear themselves to those in power. The reality of the matter is that allegiance just usually lies with the one at the top. This is something that's true in the politics of government, within things like sports, but as many of you know, especially within the political context of the workplace. The counsel of Solomon here is that the best thing that a person can do, especially if they're a servant, low on the chain, which is what he means here by bedchamber, is do not assume that anything you say will actually stay with the ears of the one with whom you were speaking. And while the sin of grumbling and gossip are those things which so utterly displease a sovereign God who is in control of every circumstance and who's made no wrong judgments with regard to his providence, at a very practical level, there's still just something incredibly unwise about thinking that you can actually somehow speak your folly behind a closed door and just assume that nobody is going to find out. Solomon says all it takes is the wrong word to the wrong person at the wrong time to completely expose you for what you are and therefore bring you to ruin. And so Solomon here, wanting to show a better and indeed a more worshipful way to make use of your mouth, simply says, so do not be so foolish. Do not assume that some little bird won't somehow bring your words to the ears of the king. So what's the final word to us here at the end of Solomon's final section of Proverbs? I think what Solomon would want us to know, because it does seem to be one of his favorite terms besides the word havel, is that in a life lived under the sun, and in a life that is completely twisted and broken and fractured, is that there is just a way to the design of God and even to the mind of Solomon that's just simply better. What you have in these verses is just a sheer contrast between the way of folly and the way of wisdom. And so what I want to say is that if Proverbs 9 and verse 10 is correct, that the beginning of wisdom is in fact the fear of the Lord, then the path of the fool is actually something that's dug from a heart that does not want God. A heart that does not desire him, that does not fear him. And beyond that, there's also a kind of wisdom seeker whose only desire for wisdom is simply driven from the pragmatic good that it's going to do for them. In fact, this is why so many actually end up rejecting biblical counsel. It just doesn't work for them. But the reality for Solomon and what he is going to show us is that that kind of person is never actually going to find wisdom. Now, they might understand wisdom, but they'll always lack the ability and even desire to apply it. And the reason for that is because they actually love laziness. They love gossip. They love their sin. And so if all you want is ease and comfort and pleasure and things to go your way so that you might gain power and wealth or just stuff, and you think that God or religion is somehow going to do that for you, then the truth of the matter is that wisdom is actually further from you than you even know. But if your heart's desire is to actually honor God with your life, that is to make much of him and his grace and his gifts to you, whereas you grow in your knowledge of who he is and in who you are as a creature before him, then the truth of Solomon is that your life will not only be one that's perhaps experiencing less difficulty, but it'll also be a life that's better simply because it'll forever be a life that's worship. Which at the end of the day, and as we'll see in chapters 11 and 12, is actually the ultimate purpose and meaning for your life. It's the reason you've been created. It's the ultimate reason for why God has given to any of us breath. And so my final word this morning on a passage of Proverbs is simply this. Pursue wisdom. Pursue it well. Pursue it fully, but pursue it with a heart that's driven by a desire to worship. Wisdom has been given for your good, but ultimately it's been given for the pleasure of your Creator as your life conforms into His will. And so Solomon says, this is your lot as a creature, but it is also the pathway to joy.